From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour is made on the high school soccer field. A team is setting up for a corner kick, and one player edges into the box. With the ball placed perfectly in the air, the player uses his head to nod the ball into the corner of the net, and his teammates go crazy. He, though, only offers a kind of a goofy smile, the kind that says, hey, that kind of hurt a little bit. He laughs a little. You know, sometimes in soccer, a header is executed perfectly and the player barely feels it. But sometimes without the right technique, a header can hurt. That player was me. I was never very good in the air. Most of the time I wondered, am I going to hurt myself? And the question is it actually dangerous? When we watch sports, it's easy to see the hits that might lead to a severe injury and concussion. But what about the buildup of hits to the head that are maybe less severe or dramatic to watch, but nonetheless significant? Is it safer to go an entire career with dozens of lesser impacts to the head, or to suffer one clear-cut concussion? We've come a long way in understanding concussion, but when it comes to technology and detection, we're still waiting for something that will truly change the market and medicine. And this hour, a look at the progress. We'll also answer your questions. If you have any questions about concussion, brain injury, recovery, especially as it relates to kids on the field, you can do that as well. And we'll tell you about an upcoming event next Tuesday. So a lot to get in here. Let me welcome our guest for the hour. Dr. Jeff Bazarian's here. He is URMC's leading concussion expert. He runs a practice related to youth-related concussion at the University of Rochester Medical Center. Dr. Bazarian, welcome back. Nice to see you. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me back, Evan.
And also here is Scott Featherman. He is the business development manager at Black Box Biometrics, Inc. That's in Rochester. And he's got his own, I think, significant story to tell as well. Scott, welcome to you. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Evan. Good to meet you.
Dr. Bazarian, are we getting closer to seeing some kind of technology on the market that is a real changer, that says we can detect quickly or even get to the point where we can pull an athlete off the field before something really significant and severe happens to their brain development?
Not so sure about that. I think raising awareness is probably the biggest thing we've done. So forget about technology, but just getting people's radar screen on around the concussion issue. I think where technology really can come in is the second part you talked about, which is these repetitive hits. That's where technology, I think, really has the opportunity to keep our brains safe. So we got two kind of issues here, right? Detecting concussion, which is what you talked about in your opening story, but also kind of keeping track of all these hits that don't cause concussion, and when do we know that this is maybe starting to cause a problem for the brain? So I think with the former, the concussion, I think it's still a human element. We don't really have that magic blood test or device quite yet. But for the second thing, the keeping track of these repetitive head hits, I think that's where technology could be super helpful.
And Jeff, I know you have parents who have asked you this question, but I think it's worth getting out there right away off the bat here. They have probably asked you, do these hits build up? If my kid is playing soccer and never has a hit that says, that's an obvious concussion, you know, get them out of the game, whatever it is. You know, I was the kid who was awful with headers. I've never in my life executed a header all that successfully to the point where it didn't actually hurt a little bit, probably because I shouldn't have been in the air to begin with. But those kind of things can hurt, and you have those moments of impact that don't look like they're all that dramatic. The question is, does your brain reset, for lack of a better word, and you don't get to a concussion level right away? Or does the gradual accumulation of hits, do you get to that level anyway?
That's the $64,000 question. That's a great question to ask right at the start, because that's where research is headed. And kind of emerging research would suggest that there is some kind of cumulative effect to all of these hits that happen throughout someone's life. And where the threshold is between, you know, being okay and being not okay has yet to be determined. And that's the research we're doing, University of Rochester, and that's where technology like what Black Box has could help us answer those questions.
Well, let's talk about what Black Box is, because Scott Featherman's here, and Scott served in the 101st Airborne Division, an air assault division, is that right?
That's right, the only one in the world.
Tell me a little bit about your service.
Sure. So I started off, I actually got my commission from RIT, so I'm a local boy. I went straight into service, and when I got to the 101st Airborne, actually I went, first thing I did, I went over to Afghanistan. So, you know, got my feet wet over there, led a platoon in combat, had a lot of interesting stuff, did a lot of good things over there, and came back, finished out my time in service, and then went straight to Black Box.
You know, you could mention you know, that you were awarded the Army Achievement Medal, the Bronze Star Medal, yeah?
I could.
I'll mention it for you.
Be humble about it. Thank you.
I'll mention it for you. You were awarded the Army Achievement Medal and the Bronze Star Medal for your actions in Afghanistan. Yeah. Do you not want to tell us what led to that? Would you rather not?
Well, we did a lot. It wasn't so much a specific circumstance. It was more an overall for both awards, just some actions that a lot of us did over there. And, one thing that really brought me to have a passion in this space, whether it's sports or, you know, all the blast concussion work that Black Box has done traditionally. I had a few injuries myself that, you know, didn't even know at the time, didn't show the symptoms. But now looking back after my 3 years with Black Box, I've learned a lot. I've learned a lot about the science. And looking back, I definitely know that myself and a lot of other people were harmed a lot more than we thought we were at the time. And it was just from those blast incidents that we don't really know about.
Yeah, and we talk about our servicemen and women. We've talked about traumatic brain injury and recovery. And again, the more dramatic cases are easier to understand. Yeah. But from your service, Scott, you know, my guess is there are a lot of other, again, the smaller buildup of impacts that maybe not even coming from combat, maybe come from different scenarios that may be impacting brain development in some way.
Yeah, absolutely. And, it's sort of, you don't even realize it because it's little things, you know. So, you know, everybody thinks about the IED strike, you know, the catastrophic on a vehicle, something to that effect, or, you know, someone falling and hitting their head real hard. But, you know, sort of in the same way as sports, there's those big ones, you know, that you know about, but then there's all these little ones. There's, exposure to being too close to an artillery weapon, a mortar firing, even friendly outgoing. Right, firing a shoulder fire rocket, all those things we're finding have effect on the brain. And it's not something we knew when I was in, certainly in 2011 over in Afghanistan, but it's something that we're starting to know now.
Jeff, you were nodding there. I mean, I know your practice is focused on athletics. How familiar are you with some of at least the scenarios he's describing?
Pretty familiar. I did, you know, I worked for the government, the Department of Defense, and the Institute of Medicine to help understand some of these relationships in the military. And I really thank Scott for his service. And that's one of the reasons why I wanted to get involved, because I didn't do what he did. But so I am familiar, and he's spot on with what he's saying.
Okay. And Scott as well. Yeah. Thanks for the service.
Thank you.
That you did. And you decided now that you're going to work for Black Box Biometrics. You came back in 2013 to do that.
That's right.
What is Black Box Biometrics?
So, you know, at the time when I first came back, my best friend was working there. It seemed like a great place to work. I liked what they were doing all around the blast gauge, right? And so the blast gauge system is our bread and butter. It's our core technology. We started out with that in 2011 as a DARPA program, really to explore all those overpressure incidents. And we use overpressure as the shockwave that comes off a blast. And it's actually the primary cause of injury, though everybody thinks of, shrapnel or burns or something to that effect. Well, you get those too. It's actually the shockwave that is causing the long-term issues with the brain and the central nervous system, right? So, finding out about all that, I said, hey, this is something that I could really passionately spend my life on. You know, I want to continue to help soldiers, you know, a lot like Dr. Bazarian. You know, I want to help people who are in this this field still. And started learning more. It was great. When I came in, we started, you know, going after the blast gauge, really going after international militaries as well as Department of Defense, trying to make this issue a little bit more well known. And the blast gauge is a lot like our sports sensor in that it picks up the overpressure shockwave, the blast shockwave, and gives you a quick readout to tell you how bad that blast was, so that somebody in a medical position can make a good determination about what that injury could be.
Okay, so what's it look like?
Oh, so it's really small. It's about a little bit bigger than a quarter, and it's solid black. We wear three of them, back of the head, non-firing shoulder, and chest. And those little things are pretty rugged. They're blast-proof, and it just has a little silver dome. And underneath that dome lies the pressure sensor. We also have three lights, so we're able to give you a green, yellow, red and that's kind of a core. We've always done the green, yellow, red with our company. That green, yellow, red gives you a quick triage of, you know, green, good to go, yellow, a moderate blast has been detected, and red is there's a severe. And in the military, they use the yellow and red to tell the medics, you know, who needs the attention first, right? Who's the person who has the most exposure? And they can go and they can make a good decision based off that data.
All right, so let's say someone has fired a shoulder-fired weapon.
Sure.
Is that likely to be a yellow or a red?
Yeah, it's usually a yellow based on some of the studies that we've seen. So that's right in the moderate range between 4 and 16 PSI. And so, you know, we kind of go back to, we question whether, you know, between the 4 and 16 PSI and a single exposure, you know, what really is the neurological damage there? That's still up in the air. Like Dr. Bazarian said, we're trying to establish that. But what we are starting to see in the science, I think, based on what I've seen, that there's accumulation becomes a problem. So if you see a lot of these yellows, or a lot of even the greens, what we call what would normally be considered a safe single exposure below 4 PSI, see a lot of those, you could still have an issue.
All right, and that tracks exactly with the athletics, this question on the buildup and trying to understand what a buildup means for the human brain. So on the battlefield, in the military service, and on the athletic field. I mean, Jeff, how many... In a single soccer game, you could have a few dozen impacts to the head in some way, couldn't you?
Right, and in football, even more. Ice hockey, right.
And when it comes then, Scott, to what you're doing in our servicemen and women, they could have dozens of green lights, right? I mean, it doesn't have to be a red light.
That's right.
It could have dozens of green lights or yellow lights.
Yeah, we see that quite a bit. There was sort of a recent study that went on that Walter Reed led, and they looked at artillery firing. You know, one of the things I mentioned earlier, guys who are just doing their job standing next to an artillery gun firing, they see 30 to 300 exposures to blast a day. And, you know, what we're really looking at is if you're getting 300 a day and you're doing that 4 or 5 days a week, what does that do to you neurologically?
All right, so now... Is the goal to broaden what Black Box can do in terms of offering this kind of technology?
Yeah, absolutely. So it was a pretty easy move. All the times at trade shows or telling people about what we did about BLAST, we heard people, oh, you should do something like that for the NFL, right? That's really the thinking. You know, you jump first to the NFL. And, you know, we agreed, of course, and we started...
Hold on here. Does the NFL hasn't... I thought that they told me concussion isn't even real. I'm mostly kidding. I'm sorry. I shouldn't be so flippant. They haven't been as, I don't think their record is, but it was very ambitious of you to think you can go right to the NFL.
It was, well, you know, I don't think we ever wanted to go straight to them, and I still don't know if that's the right approach, right? I mean, I think where our heart is as a company has always been kind of around the youth. Really concerned over people who are developing, you know, how much extra problem does that generate, you know, in a developing brain? And, you know, it's not that we don't want to help the NFL players, but, you know, honestly, the NFL might be high profile, but there's not very many of them. You know,
yeah,
there's
right.
So many people in youth sports comparatively. And, you know, we're looking to help everybody with this. So, you know, I wouldn't say NFL was a target, but that is funny because that's where people's minds always jump to. Hey, you should make this for the NFL, not, you know, you should
Let's
make
figure
this
out
for
the smallest market you could possibly
right,
have.
Right, and go after that.
But you know what, though? If it works, it's going to end up there eventually, isn't it? Something that actually works is going to find its home for a market. Quality will probably decide with this. So, okay. So what you described on the, at least for military service members, is small. Is it exactly the same technology, and how would it be applied in an athletic context?
No, you know, fundamentally it's different, though we tried to take everything we learned from the blast gauge and apply it. So it's the same, you know, black color, it's very strong. We use a molding process that makes it very hard to damage, even with direct hits. This thing is very thin. Think of a stick of gum. So we're looking very thin, very slender. And you put that into a skull cap or a headband, whichever you prefer, whether it's under helmet, whether it's in soccer, you can wear this, and it gives you the impact readout, where the blast gauge gave you the readout that tells you, hey, you know, you've been exposed to a blast. This one tells you, hey, your head has been exposed to a major impact that could possibly cause a concussion.
Jeff, how do you feel about this?
I feel great about it, because this is exactly what we need to know to understand what's happening with the brain. We need to know that what we call exposure, and figure out how it relates to brain injury. And without the exposure, we can't unlock the brain injury piece. It's very similar to like a radiation badge. You know, you see radiation doctors and radiologists wear this little badge, and it's kind of keeping track of their cumulative radiation exposure. And every month they send it in and have it analyzed. And if it's above a certain level, they say, oh, you got to back off. We need a similar kind of device for contact sports.
Now, if I can on that, so you bring up a really good point. I'm glad. So we've looked into the radiation badge technology quite a bit. It's a really strong corollary for both our devices, right? So you really have to know, for this to become, you know, the perfect system, you need to know how many impacts and at what level are going to end up being a problem, right? And so they had this same problem with x-rays back in 1920s, 1930s, I think, when they were first trying to work with the idea. And, you know, what they were finding is they couldn't make any correlation to injury because a lot of the injury was a solid tumor cancer. And that took 20, 30 years to develop. So they had to look at these people 20, 30 years later, and they had to know exactly what the exposure was. So I think what I'm trying to drive at is they had to start measuring and they had to start getting that objective data. And then 20 years later, they were able to come out, I think 1950s, 1960s, they came out with some sort of a recommended limit. And they were wrong. You know, and they revised that limit quickly several times, I think. But, you know, it's a very strong corollary to what we're doing here. So.
Listeners, if you have questions or comments about the future of understanding concussion, if you've got questions about maybe scenarios that affected your own family, I mean, these are the guests who can help us with this. Dr. Jeff Bazarian's here from URMC, and Scott Featherman is the business development manager at Black Box Biometrics. That's a company, is it based here in Rochester?
Yes, it is. Yeah, we're right across from RIT.
Okay. You can call the program. It's toll-free, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Scott, if this works and takes hold, how many sports, how many athletics are going to end up using this kind of technology?
You know, we've been blown away just when we're kind of getting out into the market a little bit. We did a little unveiling at CES to test things out, and that was a year and a half ago. We've been blown away at how many different applications we hadn't even thought of. So we've heard from people in NASCAR. We've heard from people in motocross. We've heard from synchronized swimmers. We've heard from divers. It goes on and on with bicyclists. Like, there's so many people that want to know exactly what the impact was. And when we started, we were really just thinking about the soccer, football, ice hockey, lacrosse, what we really called the big four. But our eyes have been open since then.
Okay. And if this takes hold the way you hope it can, if the technology works, if it finds a market, eventually the impact is what? Describe for me what parents and athletes are doing based on using this technology.
Well, Dr. Bazarian said it right in the beginning, is he sort of mentioned that there's the human element first and then there's the technology that kind of comes later. I still see that being the symbiotic relationship. What we're trying to do is we're trying to give the medical professional, the parent, the coach, whoever's making play or stay decisions, we want them to have more data. And so we're trying to give them objective data that is accurate enough that they can make a better decision about whether or not to sit an athlete.
All right, so this is the point that I have to just say. I hope that culture can come along with technology, because right now we valorize the athlete who never gets off the field. You know, he went back out there and, you know, I joke about the NFL because I think they're the most egregious, and probably all of us who've ever even covered the NFL contribute to that. You know, it doesn't have to be in the Super Bowl, but how a player gets praised for going back out there when it looks like they were hit by a bus, the way their head is reacting. I mean, it is pretty remarkable. But we valorize this notion of you got to pull him off the field. You know, that player won't get off the field. He wants to get back in there. Dr. Bazarian, you must talk to parents and athletes themselves who are in that category. And I don't mean, I certainly don't mean to malign someone. I understand it, having played sports myself. But we're going to need a culture change if this technology works to say, look, you don't think you have a concussion, or you may not even have a concussion, or you may be building to a threshold but you're not there yet. That they're going to look at you and say, but I'm not there yet. I'll be more careful. You can't pull me out of a game before I'm as hurt as I could be.
Yeah. That's a great point. I think the other link to this is the neuroimaging. So I think for most people, seeing is believing. So you're right. If I get up in front of them and say, your kid's done, the sensor's telling me too many hits, I totally agree. They're going to say, show me. So the neuroimaging is now catching up so that we can see this low-level brain injury on a scan. Now, they're still kind of research kind of scans, but they'll soon be in clinical practice. So that if I think we could then address a parent's concern, and maybe the sensor will, as Scott mentioned, maybe we'll say, okay, you know, you've reached some kind of threshold. We're not going to say you're done forever, but you need to see someone like me who can maybe do a scan and see, okay, now do you have something that we need to worry about? And that, I think, is what's going to be helpful. I totally agree. I mean, there's too much variation from person to say that one threshold is going to apply to hundreds and thousands of patients.
But I'm excited about the idea that this technology may put us in a position for, like, let's say my son is playing a sport in high school, and you can use this technology to say, look, Evan, he may be a hit or two away from the kind of, you know, a more severe impact brain injury-wise. And we're not talking about, again, a huge impact. We might be talking about sort of a game-by-game regular level hit. And I would hope that I, as a parent, would take that opportunity to say, all right, what's the prognosis? Do we need to rest for a while? Does he need to sit a game? Does he need to sit four games? I would hope that I would, but what I'm hinting at with the culture change, Jeff, is I don't want to be cynical about the world of parents and sports and athletics, not just on the professional level, but you don't believe right now we're there.
No, we're definitely, I mean, it's because of that scene is part, it's not there. But the culture change for baseball and pitch counts, I mean, it didn't take many people to have Tommy John surgery for people to understand, okay, after 90 pitchers or so, that guy's coming out. I mean, people don't say, what a wimp. They go, all right, he pitched 90 pitches, he's out.
No, Curt Schilling does. Curt Schilling thinks that they're all babied and that the way to get stronger pitchers is to let them throw 200 pitches. He says, look at them in Japan. They don't have pitch counts, and they come over here and they've got rubber arms. Everybody will rationalize, I guess, is the point. But maybe Schilling is more of an outlier, and what you seem to be saying is at least that's become more normalized. Pitch counts are more normalized. Preventing injury before it happens, something that's preventive as opposed to reacting to injury.
Yeah, and the key was the Tommy John surgery, which is like, okay, that's what I don't want to have.
Yeah.
So the scan, I think, is the visual image on this advanced neuroimaging is the key piece. You don't want to have your kid, because we can't point to someone who's got chronic traumatic encephalopathy 30, 40, 50 years down the line. That's too far away for a parent to kind of visualize. And the number of people that end up getting there proportionally is pretty small. We don't really know how people get there.
And on the military scale, Scott, I mean, can you imagine servicemen and women? They're not, you know, staying back at base for the day because they got enough yellows. You know what I mean? And I'm not saying they should or shouldn't, but I mean, I'm saying that culture is probably the same way in the military as we see it in sports, that we valorize even when we're at risk here, don't you think?
Yeah, definitely. And I would say, while they correlate very well, both people, both scenarios, they're going back to not wanting to let down their team. I think that's normally the core.
Yeah, I'm not maligning it. I'm just observing the culture.
Right, absolutely true. But I think the way to change this thinking a little bit and help the culture move along is that you can be letting down the team if you're not 100%. And so it's huge when you are in the military because you are making life and death decisions. And what I ask the guys who I work with all the time who say exactly that, hey, even if I'm a yellow or a red, I need to go back out to help my team. Well, my question is, I point to some, you know, some studies that have said that there's slower reaction time, there's poor decision making, there's nausea, which causes poor physical performance. If you want to be the person that's really dragging your team down in a life or death scenario, you need to make that decision very carefully. You know, so you don't even have to point to long-term necessarily. You know, in sports, sure, it's not a life or death decision, you know, or scenario here, but, you know, it's the big game. For a lot of people, they look at it like it's life or death because this is everything for them. And so do you want to be 100%?
Yeah.
I think that's the question.
I think, first of all, Dr. Bazarian was nodding at every moment of that. I mean, I think that is the best articulated answer to this notion of you'd be letting down your team if you stayed out. So when, you know, Scott's saying sometimes when you stay in, you're letting down your team. Jeff, you're on board with that idea, aren't you?
100%. And I mean, I think about just, you know, firing a weapon and how if you're just off by a little bit, instead of hitting the bad guy, you hit the good guy. I mean, I think all that's right, spot on.
And I think then the question becomes whether it's athletics or it's in a military capacity, you've got to get a superior, you know, whether it's a coach or military leadership, has to sometimes make the call based on the medical information, whether it's, you know, using black boxes technology or whatever else is developed in the future. It may require enough data that says, if you've got so many yellows, it's not that you'd be letting your team down. You go back out there right away, you're not as sharp, you could be endangering lives. In sports, you're not letting your team down if you go back out there with this many yellows. You're not going to perform at the same kind of level. And it may require a coach or military leader to say, we're going to take this data and we're making the call. Do you agree with that?
I do, definitely. And, you know, to really use it.
Because the player is always coming back in.
You're so right. They're going to come back in. When you come back in, you want to be sharp. You can, you know, you don't have to look extreme long term. You can even look, you know, just with an intelligent look at your future. A lot of these people who are putting so much on the big game, it's because they want to go somewhere with sports. They want the college scholarship. They want to make pro something, you know, or at least be on that path, right? If you are hurting yourself in the short term, especially when it comes to concussion brain injury, you might actually be ruining that dream for yourself, you know, if you're hurting your chances long term by getting too many concussions now.
Okay. Dr. Bazarian, agree?
Right. Yep. I mean, I still think the bigger issue is not the concussions, it's still these hits that don't cause a concussion, and that's where things get dicey, because if a device goes off and says you've just reached some kind of threshold and it's the middle of the big game and everybody's feeling good, it's going to be a lot more difficult to make that decision to have someone come out.
All right, let's get our only break of the hour. And when we come back, I want to tell you about an event that's coming up on Tuesday, D-Sports, the 2016 Summit. It's at Oak Hill Country Club. It is this coming Tuesday, the 16th, and we're going to tell you all about that. We'll also take some of your questions that have come in via email. Alex, Elizabeth, and more, I've got those. We're going to get those for Dr. Bazarian and Scott Featherman, our guests. And if you want to call the program, we're talking concussion, brain injury, recovery, and the future of treatment. It's 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI. If you're in Rochester, 263-9994. And Monday on The Next Connections, we're going to talk about a new program designed to increase minority representation in the city's police, firefighting, and security forces, a partnership between the city and the Rochester City School District. We'll talk to RCSD graduates that are now working in those fields. That's Monday. And welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, and we're flying through this Friday here. And our guests are talking about concussion, brain injury, and impacts, whether it's far afield in military capacity, and now what Black Box is doing to broaden that to the athletic field, and helping kids in many ways deal with injuries, but sometimes prevent injuries before they get more severe. Dr. Jeff Bazarian is here. He is URMC's leading concussion expert, and he runs a practice related to youth sports-related concussion at the University of Rochester Medical Center. And Scott Featherman is business development manager at Black Box Biometrics, that is in Rochester, across from RIT. How many people are working at Black Box now? How big a company?
I think we're about 14, 15 strong. So we're growing. We're a nice small family.
Well, you're about to grow if this works out.
I hope so.
You're about to certainly grow if this comes out here. Jeff Bazarian, what's coming up on Tuesday with the summit here? It's at Oak Hill Country Club on Tuesday. What's going on?
Yeah, I think the idea behind this conference is to bring technology like Black Box and the big data that come out of it and figure out a way to bring those things together to prevent sport injuries or to improve the recovery from sport injuries. So I'll be on a panel with Scott and others talking about concussion, but there's going to be people talking about knee injuries and about rehabilitating from other things, not just concussion. But we've got these devices, and Scott can speak to this, crank out a tremendous amount of data. It doesn't just say, oh, hit A. It's tremendous amount of data that has to be filtered and analyzed. And so we need a system for doing that. And this kind of meeting brings people together to think about those things.
All right. So it's 8 a.m. to 4 p.m. on Tuesday at Oak Hill Country Club. Really aimed, Jeff, at who? Who are the type of people who should come out on Tuesday?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, there are a lot of people that would be interested in knowing how to combine big data with technology. Some of them will be other folks in the technology space or IT folks in the data space. Some of them will be researchers like myself, coaches and trainers and athletes. I mean, there's a kind of a broad audience here, and I think we're trying to shoot for all of those groups.
Okay, and if you want to sign up, you can still do that. Much more information at D Sports Summit, the letter D, by the way. Letter D, dsportssummit.org, dsportssummit.org. So much more information on the day-long event there that is focused on applying data analytics and technology to predicting and preventing sports injury, and all of that there. So check it out there. You can still get involved on Tuesday, and that's a good sense of what is coming up. I want to work through some of the emails, questions that have come in. Alex writes to the program and wants to know if our guests can rank the sports in terms of how dangerous they are for the human brain. Is there a ranking, Jeff Bazarian, on this?
I don't think
there's not a hierarchy.
I don't think so.
You have a chart on your wall in your office?
It's more like a bullseye with the bad sport in the center.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a database of retired athletes who have developed this chronic traumatic encephalopathy, which is early dementia, and the majority of people in that database are football players. I don't know that means that football is the most dangerous sport, but it's probably up there. And then ice hockey and boxing are next. But I don't know of any formal ranking. But if we were to look at that kind of group of people that had this CTE thing, football, boxing, ice hockey.
Football, boxing, ice hockey.
I don't know if in that order, but just those are the big ones.
Not soccer.
Soccer's in there, but it's kind of a small number of people in there.
What do you see the most of in your own practice?
Football.
You do see football.
Yeah, followed by, you know, soccer and volleyball is huge in my practice. Volleyball, a ton of volleyball-related concussions. And there's nobody in that database with chronic traumatic encephalopathy from playing volleyball, but it does seem to produce a lot of concussions.
No, I mean, I've seen Meet the Parents, and there's terrible things can happen in volleyball. In fact, if you're watching Olympic volleyball right now, they hit the ball really hard. It is really amazing. We had an email from a listener. Oh, it's amazing how fast I can lose things here. As I try to pull it back up, the listener wanted to know if your guests had seen the bike crash at the Olympics. We were talking about that before this program began. A little bit of background first, then I'll get to the emailer's question. If you missed it, in bicycling at the Olympics over the last week or so, men and then women did their road races, and the course was a big uphill climb, and then the last 20 kilometers were really downhill toward the finish line. And there were sections of the downhill that sort of wove back and forth, and the riders were going 50 to 60 miles an hour dealing with these turns, and a Dutch rider, the female Dutch rider who was in the lead by far, I mean really on track for a gold medal, I think overcorrected on a turn, went over the handlebars head first, straight into the curb, landed face and head straight into the curb, and for minutes didn't even move on there. Riders are passing her, cars are passing. Her mother back home in Holland was watching on her birthday to celebrate what she thought was going to be a gold medal, and then said, for 20 minutes, I thought my daughter was dead. Now, her daughter did not die. She suffered a concussion, and Jeff, you were saying, I read concussion and some vertebra fractures. Is that right?
Yeah.
There's no question you look at it, it had to be a concussion, right? That wouldn't be hard to diagnose.
You don't need technology for that one.
You don't need, I mean, that would be a red center.
That's right.
No question about that.
That's right.
But what the email, who I now cannot find, was asking earlier was, should that person ever be allowed to ride again? Or what's the kind of way that if Jeff Bazarian, if you were working with that family, with that rider, that Dutch rider, obviously you have to heal your vertebrae, but let's just say it was only a concussion. What's the plan for ever getting back and eventually getting back to doing what she was doing?
This is a great question. This gives me an opportunity to say that the vast majority of people recover fully from a single concussion. And you know, I don't really know how bad this particular athlete's brain injury was. There are some that require surgery and rehabilitation, but by and large, people require absolutely fine from a single concussion. It may take a while. Some people take a little longer than others. But the recovery is complete. The problem is when that concussion is superimposed on day in and day out repetitive headaches. That's the problem. This is why we don't see rugby players in our database of people who have chronic traumatic encephalopathy, because they don't hit their heads repeatedly. They get lots of concussions, but they're not banging their heads 60, 70, 80 times a game. They don't wear helmets, so they try to avoid hitting their head. So isn't that... sounds kind of paradoxical, right? It's just really, so recovery from these big concussions, no problem. These multiple repetitive headaches that kind of blow low below the surface, those are the things that can cause lifelong problems down the line.
All right, so this Dutch rider may have a tough road of it to come back from these injuries first, and then obviously every brain is different, every person is different. But she'll ride again. She could be
as long as she doesn't play football. She should be fine.
Okay, all right. I can't avoid this. This happens every time Jeff's here. But Alyssa, this and it's not always Melissa. Melissa sends an email, but it's always somebody who wants to know would Jeff and your guests allow their kids to play XYZ sports? Melissa want to know about football, but I'll change Melissa's question and ask you, are there any sports where you wouldn't allow your kids to play?
That I wouldn't allow?
You would not allow them to play based on the risk of head injury.
Okay, so I'm not going to answer that question. Okay. So let me answer the first question, because I think this comes down to risk and benefit, Evan. For everybody's different, right? So basically, what benefit is this kid getting from the sport versus what's the risk? And that equation is different for everyone. I mean, I'm a different socioeconomic strata. I'm white. So the benefit of my kid doing a sport may be different than someone who's in a different situation who may be of color and poor and needs the sport for different reasons. So the benefit's going to differ from person to person. The risk, we're trying to hammer that out right now. I can't assign a risk figure for you. We know that there's some risk to playing football over the long term. Is it like getting struck by lightning, or is it like a 10%? We don't really know. So on the medical side, we're having trouble quantifying that risk. We know there's something there. We just don't know how big it is. On the benefit side, that's going to change from person to person. So maybe for me and my family and my kid, I'd say, no, not worth it. When I weigh those two things together, risk and benefit, it doesn't work for me. For someone else, it might work. So it really, I have to say this, but it really kind of depends.
That's the first time I've ever heard socioeconomics and privilege in an answer about this, and I really admire that. I think I'd never thought of it in that context, but I think that's a very interesting way to do it. And I'm sure you have to talk to families every day
all the time
to come up with those.
This is exactly the conversation we have.
Yeah. Wow. You want to answer that one, Scott?
Oh yeah, yeah. So I do have two kids. They're not old enough to be doing any sort of serious football or anything yet. But you know, when it comes time, based on everything that I know, I would not restrict them from any sports. Now, I would take every precaution available to me. Right, that'd be very important. I would get a great concussion doctor if there were any concussions that were detected, and then I would also take every precaution available as far as finding and categorizing those subconcussive hits. If down the line we're able to point to the fact that 111 impacts over this period of time is bad, I would want to know for sure that my kid had 111 impacts if they did, right? So I would take every precaution, but I wouldn't prohibit them from playing at this point.
Okay. Ryan writes to the program and says, coming in late, just wanted to know more about the technology. He had heard the tease earlier today. So let's reset this for you. Scott Featherman's here from Black Box Biometrics, and the technology that Ryan is emailing about is, what's the technology called?
Sure. So yeah, I don't know if I actually went through it completely. So it's the Lynx IAS. IAS stands for Impact Assessment System. It's been developed over the past 3 years here in Rochester. We've done quite a bit of field demonstrations, field trials, getting them out, getting a lot of feedback in the development. It's a small, about a pack of or a single stick of gum in size, and you know, real strong, has an integrated battery. What it does is it picks up any impact to the head with accelerometer and gyroscope, and it relays all that information via Bluetooth to an app. And that app, real time, gathers data for an entire team or all the way down to just one person, and puts that data at the fingertips of somebody like an athletic trainer, a coach, a parent, somebody who's really responsible. When they see enough impacts happen to a certain player that they have concern, or when they see a major impact happen, it just gives them more tangible information, objective data, that they can do something about what could be an issue.
Okay, and for lack of a better question, forgive the ignorant business speak here, but how far along is this development? I mean, how close are you to being able to produce this kind of technology or to offer it more broadly?
Sure. Right. Developmentally, from a technology level, we're there. Okay. We're ready. We've been able to get them on teams. We've been able to get feedback. All right. Now, the big piece that I don't think we have yet is how we go to market. And I think we're holding on until I really have a good grasp on that answer, because I want to do it the right way. There's some competitive technologies that are out there, and we don't get the impression that they're doing extremely well, because a lot of people, they still don't even know about them, and they're on the market. When we go, we want to do it right. We want to be able to get a lot of proper feedback and have the science on our side when we tell you a certain number.
I want to bring in a perspective, but I'm going to withhold a name to protect this person who is just sharing a thought as a local coach. Could this technology just be setting coaches up to get sued?
Sure. Yeah, I certainly hope not. That's one of the many things that we're trying to make sure we play out thoroughly. before we launch this thing into the market. There's going to be some, and we've already seen this, some friction between the coach, who really is evaluated on how many times he wins. Let's be honest, right? He has to take care of his players, and I'm not saying that they don't, but most coaches are evaluated on their win, right? So they're really concerned about the win. Parents have different concerns. Insurance companies have different concerns. Lawyers have different concerns. And everybody is sort of playing out in different ways in this space. So it's something we're trying to be very cautious of.
Well, that coach follows up to say, God forbid there's a serious head injury. Could they just go back at some point, look at the data, and there's a chance that over the duration of the game that there was a hit hard enough? You know, in other words, could the data be used against a coach for not being preventive enough? You know what I mean, Scott?
Sure, it's possible, but we would have to, you'd have to prove in court that, you know, this information was clear to the coach that there should have been something done. And I think what we've said up till now, we're not quite there in the science. We're not at the point where we say, you know, hey, you exceeded a 70 and you let that go. It was a 75 was recorded and you continued to play. And we're not there, but if we were there, I think the coach would know that and would know what they have to do, right? We have concussion protocols right now with different things to do during concussions. We're just adding more data to that. And I would ask the question, are coaches being sued over our current concussion protocols, not following them?
Yeah, I think, I mean, I hadn't thought about the question on legality, lawsuits. We're a little bit of a litigious society. Yeah. My guess is you've thought about that too, though.
Absolutely, yeah, quite a bit. And we've heard it from coaches. You know, we haven't been developing this in a vacuum. So we've talked to coaches at length, athletic directors, parents about this, the parents who may levy the lawsuit and try to get their perspective on it.
All right, what are the other concerns that you've heard from coaches?
A lot of them comes down to, hey, forcing me to bench somebody when it's not the right time to bench somebody. And so my response always is that we're not going to tell you that one way or the other. The person who's making any decision is going to be the same person who already makes the decision. So if it's the coach making the decision right now for to sit somebody or not, that's going to be their decision. When they have more data, they're just going to have more data to make the decision.
All right. I've been chewing on what Scott and Jeff were saying earlier, which I thought Scott articulated really, really well. The idea that, of course, a player or of course a soldier thinks, I'm not taking myself off the field. I'm going to participate and help the team. And as Scott said, there are times where, you know, a buildup of hits to the head, potential brain injury or that kind of thing can make you less effective. And as a player, yeah, you don't want to come out, but the coach has to take you out. But now I'm thinking of a scenario where a high school team has one player who is so far superior and is the clear MVP of the team that even that player at 80%, at 60%, is better than everybody else. And it's hard. The player doesn't want to come out, and the coach thinks, then that argument goes away, that the coach can't say, you're not helping the team anymore because he's still more effective, even if he's not as sharp. Then it becomes an ethics question, and then we would have to rely on the coach to make the right decision based on the technology. And I guess in those scenarios, Scott Featherman, it would be hopefully the technology is clear enough that the coach is going to make the right call for that player's health.
Yeah, that's a really hard decision. If I had to make it, if I did it with the game on the line, you know, quick, I would just want as much information as I could, right? You have a hard decision, you just gather information, you know, as quickly as you can, and you make the best decision you can at the time. I would like to provide good, clear information, and we do that right now with our IAS score. We try to give them an aggregate score, single number, between 0 and 99 to be able to make that decision real time, you know, but I want to keep making sure that we give the right information and the best information available to the coach so we can help them make that decision.
All right, Janice writes to the program with a lacrosse question. She says, where is lacrosse in the hierarchy of risk? My 12-year-old grandson plays a lot of lacrosse, also plays soccer and ice hockey. That's from Janice.
So there is, of course, risk of both the subconcussive and concussive injury with lacrosse, and that risk is a little different for men and women because the game is different. Women don't wear helmets, and they tend not to use their head as much in play compared to boys, men who are wearing helmets, although they tend to use their head a little bit more in the game. So the risk is a little different. It's still not quite to the level of football, but it's not like badminton. So it's somewhere in between.
Okay. Eleanor writes and says, and Dr. Bazarian, you'll have to tell me if this is something that you can address. She says, could your guests comment on how their work relates to research on shaken baby syndrome? Is that related to head injury or impact on brain?
It's loosely related. I mean, when a parent shakes a baby, the head's rotating back and forth, and that's the mechanism of concussion. It's that head rotation. But I think the similarities kind of stop there, so I'm not so sure I could say much more about that.
Okay. Well, we've got a few minutes left here, and I'll remind you what's coming up on Tuesday. If you want to check it out, the D-Sports Summit is at Oak Hill Country Club. That's August 16th, Tuesday. Starts at 8 a.m., and you can still sign up at dsportssummit.org. D, just the letter D, dsportssummit.org, if you want to check out more and sign up and be part of it. It's a day-long event with demonstrations led by developers of different devices. Black Box, be there and showing off as well a little bit, Scott.
That's right. We'll have a little display. You can interact with our technology a little bit, see it in person.
Can I just add something that you guys just talked about?
Yeah.
Did you have one more thing you wanted to say?
Oh, no, I'm just looking at the list here. So just letting people know, because it's demonstrations as well. It's discussions, demonstrations, a lot going on Tuesday, dsportssummit.org. Jeff, go ahead.
I think you guys were talking a second ago about the coach and the player being the people that have to grapple over this sensor and the data. But Scott, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think some of the systems, including yours, the hit impact data goes up to a server and then can go to the parent's smartphone or so the parent could be involved in this decision as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And that creates a little bit more friction, it can possibly, right? So there's parents who want to get involved in this as well, as they should. We don't want to remove that. But our data does get pushed up into the cloud real time and pushed back down to the parent wherever they are. So even if the parent is at work, at the office, they can get an alert on their phone that says they've been, their child has been exposed to an impact above a certain level.
Oh, boy. I mean, I think that's great data to have, great information for parents to have. I think of coaches who feel like parents already micromanage, but this is a case where maybe a parent should have a hand in. I mean, I think the complaint that parents sometimes can micromanage when kids are in athletics is probably fair, but this is a place where that's different. And maybe a coach would tell me I'm wrong. I don't know. Jeff, you kind of smiled a little when I mentioned parents.
Yeah, well, the problem is that we don't really know enough about either concussion or subconcussive head hits to make this anything other than a little bit anxiety provoking. So I give you an example. 75 times the gravitational pull is where most people who have a concussion have a hit over that 75 G thing. But there are lots of people that hit their heads over 75 Gs and are absolutely fine.
Yeah.
So what do you do with that? You know, do you say, I want my kid pulled out and checked? I want him pulled out. I want to leave him in. I mean, we don't really have enough information that a parent can say, you should be doing X absolutely quite yet.
All right, let me try to get in a few more of your questions have come in via email. This comes from Teacher Guy. That's all it says. I don't know who Teacher Guy is. Teacher Guy just wants to know what happens if a player throws his helmet or drums on it. I guess the question is does that show up on the data?
Well, I haven't touched on this explicitly. So we actually don't go into a helmet. It's very important.
Okay.
Everybody who's gone inside a helmet, like actually embedded in the helmet, they've had very poor correlation to what the head is doing. The helmet tends to move during an impact differently than the head itself is.
And that's why the data hasn't been good?
And that's why the data is not very good. So what we do is we attach into a headband or a skull cap, which pulls right against the head and it stays against the head. So you would put a skull cap on with our sensor in it, and then you would put the helmet over it. That keeps the sensor against the head when the head is moving. So in that case, if the helmet comes off, you're not going to have a problem. Now, I do see what he's getting at. If he were to take off that sensor and throw it down on the ground, we actually would reject that as a false trigger because we have found out ways to know whether or not we're correctly on the head.
Wow. Okay. See, Teacher Guy, there's your answer. Robert emails the program and says, Evan, the detection side is important to prevent injuries from getting worse. Proactive concussion management through rotational neck strength can reduce risk of concussion on the field. How do Jeff and Scott view the balance of proactive actions pre versus post concussion? That's from Robert.
I love that idea. That caller/emailer brings up an excellent point. There is this emerging notion of prehabilitation, which is that you can do some things to the body to prevent concussion. And neck strengthening is probably the best hope right now for that happening. And the idea is that if you strengthen the neck, you get less head rotation with any particular hit. It just hasn't really been demonstrated that if you strengthen the neck, you actually reduce concussion risk. But in animals, it has. It's a super good idea. The side effects are pretty low. It's brilliant, and it's just entering into our kind of our tool belt.
And this is one of those things where, even if we don't know just how effective it is yet, there's no bad side effects.
Exactly.
You can have a stronger neck. Okay, fine. But what would you recommend? Just basic neck strength building exercises?
Oh,
A bunch of shrugs? What are we doing?
If we had a physical therapist, they could tell
there you.
Okay. I'm going to defer because there's a whole bunch of things you can do that make your neck hurt and not really increase the strength. So if I start talking, it'll probably be the wrong
thing. I'm going to go shrug it out at the gym.
I'm not sure if that's... I'm not seeing it on you, Evan.
Oh, my gosh. Listen, you're lucky your time has come here to the end of the hour here. We got about a minute left. Just some final thoughts. Scott Featherman, just some thoughts for the audience on I know Black Box has a financial stake, and if you guys are successful, you'll make some money, but you'll help a lot of people. What do you want to see happen going forward here?
Yeah, I think what we've been trying to drive home here is that it's more than just that huge concussion. We're learning that now, and we're seeing that these subconcussive hits end up being a big problem. So all I'd like to see moving forward, whether it's our technology or another one, whether it's something proactive or another, that people are taking as many precautions that they can to making sure they know how many hits there are and if they're at risk of injury.
Okay. Dr. Bazarian, some final thoughts for the audience now.
Yeah, I think Scott nailed it. You know, I think getting awareness that it's not just concussion, but it's these repetitive day in and day out hits that maybe the problem, trying to limit those in a reasonable way. Like, do we need 5 contact practices this week, or can we do 2? Seems like a very reasonable thing.
Your practice is still very busy, isn't it?
Very busy, and I'm grateful for it because I love it.
Well, no, I know. It's just, you know, one of these days, Jeff will come in here and say, our preventative work is so good. They don't even need me anymore, but I suspect that may not happen. We'll see. It's always an interesting conversation with Dr. Jeff Bazarian from URMC. Thank you, Doctor. Nice talking to you. Thanks very much, Evan. As always. And Scott Featherman, good luck to you. Black Box Biometrics. For those who have wondered, wanted to check out more, are you online?
Yeah. You can go to b3inc.com or linksias.com.
Hold on. You speak very quickly. Do it again one more time.
B3, that's the number 3, inc.com or linksias.com.
Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
All right, and have a great weekend. Our thanks to John Andrus, the engineer of this broadcast, and Megan Mack is the producer. I'm Evan Dawson, and we will talk with you Monday on Member Supported Public Radio.